at the various gatherings, the big gathering they had at Carnegie Hall for the 75th birthday of Paul Robeson, and you'll find the Harry Belafonte's, all of the towering artists who knew that they owed a tremendous debt to Paul Robeson. It's very interesting at that gathering. I think one of those powerful words were said by Coretta Scott King at that gathering. She was still mourning the death of Martin, and she said, "America did to Paul Robeson what I think they ended up doing to Martin. They buried him alive." See, Coretta's hitting on something deep. Inexcusable treatment of a person who had the courage to tell America about itself in regard to its injustices. They bury him alive.
That's Cornel West, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is one of the 20th century's most enduring and multi-talented figures. He broke through the color line and excelled in sports, film, music, and theater. He became world famous, yet in the United States, he was to be persecuted and hounded for his political beliefs. In his recordings, particularly of spirituals and folk songs, Robeson's mellifluous bass baritone voice awakened African Americans to their heritage and gained him a broad audience. He won acclaim on Broadway, especially in the musical Showboat, in which he sang the classic Old Man River. His dramatic performance in Othello is legendary. By the 1930s, he was singing in major concert halls all over the United States and Europe. By the early 1940s, one biographer states that Robeson was the most famous black man in America. Theodore Dreiser, the well-known writer of the day, hailed Robeson as an artistic and social genius. Never content to be just an entertainer, Robeson had strong political views, and he wasn't afraid to express them. He condemned racism and segregation in the United States. He was an anti-imperialist who advocated the liberation of Africa and Asia from their European colonial masters. He was an early and vociferous opponent of fascism. He visited Spain and sang for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who were fighting Franco. He admired the Soviet Union and said so openly. After World War II, the U.S. was saturated in the ideology of anti-communism. The Soviet Union, erstwhile ally, was now the arch enemy. Robeson's support for the USSR did not waver, and for it, he paid a heavy personal and professional price. He was a target of Hoover's FBI. He was verbally and physically assaulted and attacked. One notorious incident occurred in 1949 in Peekskill, New York. Robeson would later recall the baying of the lynch mob, the cries for my life from the hate-twisted mouths. In 1950, the State Department revoked his passport, declaring that Paul Robeson's travel abroad would be contrary to the best interests of the United States. Here is Robeson in his own words.
"And why do they take my passport away? They have said so in a case. They put it in a brief. They said that no matter what my political beliefs, what my standing among the Negro people of my own land in America, but they would have to take my passport away anyhow, because out of my own lips, mind you, from my own lips, for many years I have been struggling for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa, and that is meddling in the foreign affairs of the United States government. Now, that's just too bad, because I'm going to have to continue to meddle."
Having his passport taken away was a tremendous blow to Robeson's career. He was not only unable to perform overseas, but he was blacklisted domestically. His income plummeted. The return of his passport in 1958 came too late. His final years were marked by depression and illness. He died in 1976 in relative obscurity. In recent years, because of important biographies by Martin Duberman and Lloyd Brown, as well as the work and efforts of others, there's a revival of interest in Paul Robeson. One can hardly imagine a better person to talk about Robeson's legacy than Cornel West. He's been called the preeminent African-American intellectual of his generation. He's the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Professor of Philosophy at Union Theological Seminary. With his preacher-like cadences and passionate delivery, he's much in demand as a speaker. A prolific author, his book Race Matters was a bestseller. He ran for president as an independent in 2024. Cornel West gave the first annual Paul Robeson Lecture at Columbia University Law School. This classic from the AR Archives, marking Black History Month, was recorded in February 1999. And now, Cornel West.
I must say, I tremble as I rise and lift my voice to put forward reflections on Paul Leroy Robeson. There's levels of suffering, sacrifice, sadness, loneliness, courage that constitutes such a formidable challenge for us to dwell into the complexity of his life. I congratulate Columbia Law School for having the audacity to begin a lecture series in the name of the great Paul Leroy Robeson. Now, I know he's class 1923. He wasn't too crazy about the place, we should say. He had very, very pleasant memories of the dean at that time, Harlan Fisk Stone, classmates like Thomas Dewey and William O. Douglas, but he zipped through. He didn't practice law for too long, just a few months after being hired by a firm, Stonesbury and Minor firm. And after working on the will of Dick Gould, he was a stenographer who said, "I'll never take dictation from a nigger." He decided maybe he ought to do something else with his life. Never took the bar. But in the best of the Columbia Law School tradition, his mind was sharpened. But as is true in most law schools, one wonders whether the mind is not only sharpened, but also in many ways narrowed. Can you sharpen your mind and at the same time broaden it, refine it, so that you have a sense of the whole rather than zero in the specialized, professionalized, routinized way in which so much of legal studies is often done? But you have no sense of what the larger calling actually is as public servant or as analyst for various firms who themselves have a collective and public responsibility. Paul Robeson, for me, terrifying. I've never had the gumption to speak publicly about Paul Robeson because he scares me. And you can bet your bottom dollar this is going to be the last lecture I give on Paul Robeson in a long time. Because it takes too much out of me. Well, let's begin where he would want us to begin, by situating him in a story bigger than himself, situating him in a set of narratives larger than himself, understanding Paul Robeson as a small part of a great, long, rich tradition of struggle. Going back to Robeson Plantation, Crossroads, Martin County, North Carolina, his father, William Drew Robeson, born a slave, escapes at the age of 15, makes his way to Pennsylvania, engages in farm labor to pay his way through Lincoln University. His father, an extraordinary person, himself part of a larger backdrop, a wave in an ocean of those who came before, of many thousands gone, obtains his A.B. at Lincoln University, his ministerial degree at Lincoln University, and makes his way to Princeton after meeting his lovely wife, Maria Louise Bustillo, herself lineage of a grand tradition, grandfather from Sephardic Jews, who encountered Black folk in the New World, producing children like all of us, culturally hybrid. You see. And Princeton, of course, the very site where Paul Robeson was born, in his own words, spiritually located in Dixie, but geographically located in New Jersey. I happen to be a very proud holder of a Princeton degree, so I won't push this too far. But we know that Princeton was the only acceptable school for Southern elites. No accident, the first Black went to Princeton in 1947, Harvard 1872, Columbia, you tell me. Princeton's always been behind when it comes to taking seriously the vicious legacy of white supremacy. Trying to catch up lately. God help them. Made some strides lately. But Paul Robeson was born in a Jim Crow context. His father was pastor of Witherspoon Street Presbyterian Church for over 20 years, but was pushed out because he was an outspoken critic of the Jim Crow situation in Princeton. Paul Robeson never forgot it. Paul Robeson had to leave Princeton when the father was pushed out. His mother died very tragically when he was six. She was brilliant. She wrote some of her husband's sermons, which is not typical in the Black church. He moved a number of times in New Jersey, ended up in Somerville. His father had to change denominational affiliation to AME Zion because he couldn't deal with the deep racism in the Presbyterian church. And for many years, Paul Robeson lived alone with his father, the two of them. His father was 53 when he was born. He's an older man. Paul Robeson was a baby. Seven children, five survived. Paul Robeson had, in many ways, I'm saying, unbelievable privilege given the status of Black folk at the time. A deep belief in himself, in his talents, in his capabilities. He thought about going to Princeton, decided to go to Rutgers, though his father wanted him to go to Lincoln. And of course, the record at Rutgers is unbelievable. All American. Phi Beta Kappa in his junior year. Winner of the oratorical contest all 4 years, freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, senior year. First time Rutgers football team ever beat Princeton in the history of the game. You can imagine the smile that put on Brother Paul's face. And yet, as you can imagine, many schools like William and Mary and Georgia Tech refusing to play Rutgers as long as Paul was on the field. Graduates 1919. And then on to New York. Thinking about theater. Wrestling with the call of theater versus the call of law. And actually went through Columbia Law School while, in fact, he was an actor. I don't know how many of you are attempting that. It's a difficult thing to do. It's not just a matter of learning lines in one context and memorizing cases in the other.
But he pulled it off. And during the time here at Columbia, he met the love of his life, his Landa Cardozo, good essay, herself Columbia grad. God bless you. The class of 1917 obtained the first position of a black person on staff at Presbyterian Hospital. Paul Robeson met her as patient in hospital with Essie as one administering to him. Long marriage, but we're talking about buffers, what he could fall back on. Why? Because we know in his life from 1898 to 1976, he would need tremendous buffers in order to deal with the chilly whirlwinds, not just of white supremacy, but of Cold War, marginalization by mainstream black America, misunderstood, misconstrued, traveling around the world, doing what? Trying to keep alive this tradition of struggle. Always viewing himself as but one person to whom the baton had been handed to, and knowing he would have to hand that baton off to those who would come after. Paul Robeson, in many ways, reflects the plight and predicament of so many Americans, especially black Americans, who had attempted to do the same thing. Think of Frederick Douglass in 1893, 2 years before he dies. No blacks allowed at the World Exposition in Chicago. But he, being a representative of the State Department in Haiti, is able to attend as a Haitian, but not as a black American, wrestling with a despair at the end of his life. Think of T. Thomas Fortune, that grand journalistic crusader, dies all by himself in an old dilapidated hotel in Trenton, New Jersey. Think of Zora Neale Hurston, working for white mothers as a maid after writing such literary texts as Her Eyes Are Watching God, dying all alone. No tomb for the body. Think of Marcus Garvey by himself, London, Jamaica, late convert, Roman Catholicism, nearly forgotten. Think of Martin King's last years, the years that we would rather not think about. But he's saying over and over again, America is so much sicker than I thought. White supremacy saturates and permeates every nook and cranny. I thought I had victory. Is it relatively hollow as a Pyrrhic? Think of W.B. Du Bois. 1961. Joins the Communist Party at the age of 93. Leaves 2 days later and says, I've spent my whole life trying to create a multiracial democracy. I cannot conceive of the masses of black people being treated decently and kindly and equally owing to the racist tilt of most of my fellow citizens of European descent, even given the heroic efforts of the well-intended ones. Take me to Ghana and don't ever bury one molecule of my body in America. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about a Paul Robeson. Not because he's perfect or pure or pristine, but because he had the courage to look himself, America, and the world in the face and say, I want to attempt to tell the truth about it. And anytime one attempts to show the ways in which our will to truth is untruthful about itself, the way in which the American will to truth is often untruthful about itself, you're going to suffer. We know about Paul Robeson's two suicide attempts, 1961, the wrist, 65, the scissors, loving care of Paul Jr., unbelievably loving care of Paul Jr. and his wife, Marilyn Rosenberg Robeson, to keep Paul going during those 11 years of darkness, reminding one of the last years of Nietzsche and Hurdling and others. Not madness, but on the brink. What a price to pay, given the fact that in 1944, 1945, he was the loving Paul Robeson. Americans crazy about him, receiving awards from every major institution. Why? Because he was supporting the war effort. But so quickly it changes when you try to be a truth teller about America. Think of Muhammad Ali, truth teller, demonized. And after the progressive leaders and the black leaders are nearly dead, the political movements they represent relatively dormant, they're then resurrected. King the same way every January. Now he's a hero. Now Robeson, oftentimes affirmed, appreciated, but not just his body dead and gone, but what he represented more and more feeble in our society. Where are the truth tellers and witness bearers like Paul Robeson? I want to highlight three fundamental questions in regard to Paul Robeson. And the question that I think push each and every one of us to the edge of life's abyss. The first question is, what does it really mean to be human? Especially coming out of a context in which one's humanity has been systematically called into question. What does it mean to be modern? Especially out of context in which the underside of modernity is the starting point. Slavery, Jim Crow, Jane Crow, second-class citizenship, desegregation. And third, what does it really mean to be American? Wrestling with the dark side of the American experiment. Three fundamental questions have nothing to do with self-pity, nothing to do with PC, nothing to do with somehow ghettoizing and marginalizing Paul Robeson or the tradition out of which he comes. Each and every one of us have to come to terms with those three questions one way or the other. And Paul Robeson recognized that first question, what it means to be human, takes him back to the Latin root of our word human itself, humando. Great Vico in the New Science, paragraph 12, reminds us humando means bearing. To be human has something to do with burying, has something to do with relating ourselves to mass corpses who are gone, has something to do with connecting us, the quick, to the dead, has something to do with bringing together the three dimensions of time, of past and present and future. That's something very un-American to have that kind of sense of history. How do we define who we are against the backdrop of those who came before, especially those significant others? In fact, I would go as far as to say, in many ways, we are most human when we stand before the coffin and have to relate ourselves and our lives to loved ones who are lying therein. It's also humbling. You could be a professor at the law school, or you could be a homeless brother outside, but you're going to have some similar shudders and quivers when you have to relate yourself to the corpse. And death, and the forms and varieties of death, sit at the center of the tradition of struggle that Paul Robeson represents. And one of the reasons why it's so very difficult to talk about race in America, because if in fact subjugated peoples, not just black folk, working peoples, indigenous peoples, brown brothers and sisters, yellow women, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, that they have had to come to terms with social death of some sort. No legal status, no social standing, no public value. They've had to come to terms with the threats of spiritual death. You're nobody. You're less than. You see. Of course, black folk have had to come to terms both now and as well as the past with the bombardment of white supremacist claims of self-hatred. You see. Telling the world that black folk have their own hips and lips and noses and hair texture and skin pigmentation. Less beautiful, less intelligent. Always having to prove oneself as smart as rather than simply assume your capacity and do what you can with it. So much black intellectual energy and creativity has been channeled in the form of proving to the white mainstream that they're actually smarter than the stereotype that has been hegemonic. And often it's still a dead end. Because you've already given the very terrain upon which you're being defined. You'll never win that one. Jazz musicians don't have to worry about that. That's why they're freer than most law professors and law students of color. They've got different point of reference. I shouldn't say just law professors, professors in general. I'm including myself here, no doubt about that. No doubt about that. But we're talking about forms and varieties of death. Now, how do you talk about a people who are wrestling with forms of death in a death-dodging, death-denying, death-ducking civilization like America? Holding at arm's length. Already got a major challenge. How do you convince folk that in talking about your situation, you're not engaging in some kind of self-interested calculation? You're talking about something called public interest and common good and the destiny of the republic and the prospects of American democracy. More is at stake than just your particular situation. It's always fascinating to me when people talk about black folk or brown folk. It's always special interest. Talk about corporate America, American interest. Where'd that come from? Labor, special interest. Women, special interest. No, they all are constitutive components of the public interest and common good.
You're listening to Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Paul Robeson was preoccupied with the forms of social, spiritual, psychic, and sudden death in America. And it's very difficult in a hotel civilization, a sunshine civilization, to be so preoccupied with death and darkness that you not only gain a foothold, but you can sustain your foothold over time without going crazy. Because you're cutting too radically against the grain. You become a troublemaker. Why are you full of so much rage all the time? Why don't you cool off? Be like everybody else. Some of the students of color are going to encounter this in the law firms in years to come. Carrying around your Paul Robeson, you're in trouble. Yeah, we heard about him. He was full of rage. Don't be like that. Well, we've got lecture series at the law school. Yes, I know, but that's just for public discussion. We're talking about the real thing now. And of course, this affects all brothers and sisters of all colors. Paul Robeson never ever defined his project as it evolved in terms of skin pigmentation. It had to do with moral commitment and political choice. How do you talk about the legacy of forms of death in our time and in America? What kinds of deaths are necessary in order to engage in a candid and critical discussion of the forms of social death? The death of certain habits that we have, the death of certain paradigms in place, the death of certain frameworks that make it difficult to come to terms with the forms of social death, the death of certain lens through which we view the world. And by death here, of course, I'm talking about a process. A process. Elijah Muhammad used to say black folk are walking dead, and if they don't die, they'll never be alive. And if white supremacy doesn't die in America, America will never be truly America. He's right about that. Might be wrong on some other things, but he's right on that. Because he understood the language of death, like Paul Robeson's project, required that particular focus and emphasis and stress. What does it really mean to be human in the short amount of time we have in time and space, in history? What kind of people are we really? What kind of individuals are we really? Those are the questions that any discussion of race forces us to come to terms with. And that's why no one of us escape. White brothers and sisters often come up to me and say, you know, Brother Wes, I'm not a racist. I've transcended that. My uncle has much work to do, but not me. I'm younger generation. I say, I understand. I appreciate the effort. But if there's some white supremacy in me, my hunch is there's still a little in you. Too much white supremacy in black people. And after the white supremacy in Harlem, I know Westchester must have a little bit. So it's not a question of pointing fingers. It's not a question of name calling. It's a question of trying to be truthful about ourselves. When we look deep into the abyss of our own souls, we see the remnants of the larger institutional and structural forces shaping us. So that individual and structure is not some either or, race, some individual prejudice you can transcend, race, some element of a structure that is impossible to change. They go hand in hand. It's a both and choice. Why? Because as human beings, we are beings toward death, and we're also social beings wrestling with our institutions and structures, deeply shaped by them, but in no way determined fully by them. We make choices. We're moral agents. We're political agents as well. And Paul Robeson was always suspicious of institutions. Why? He never joined the Communist Party USA. But he had comrades there, you see. Always suspicious of the black church because it wasn't progressive enough, it wasn't prophetic enough. But he found solace there. NAACP relations, yes, in place, but very critical. You see, whoso be Paul Robeson like must be a nonconformist, thinking independently, critically, historically. The second question, what does it mean to be modern for Paul Robeson? And in so many ways, he was quintessentially modern because he fundamentally believed in experimenting with himself and his society. He fundamentally believed in improvisation and self-invention and reinvention, in self-making and remaking of society. To be quintessentially modern for Paul Robeson meant you had to be willing to take a risk and muster the courage to revise oneself, to thoroughly examine one's self without any dogmatic attachment to any particular institution. Now, we know Paul Robeson was wrong on many issues. certainly was wrong about the Soviet Union, certainly was wrong about the Hungarian invasion, certainly was wrong about Stalin. Why did he tilt in that direction? Well, he thought that somehow the Soviet Union would make a major contribution to anti-colonial struggles in Africa and Asia, and he knew that that underside of modernity had been overlooked by the capitalist powers. No excuse for his mistake, but still trying to keep track of the insight that is shot through that mistake. No justification for that kind of blindness to the repression and regimentation of Russian brothers and sisters or those in Eastern Europe, but also acknowledgement that for him, the wretched of the earth in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America had to be recognized. Some forms of resistance had to be put forward vis-a-vis deeply conservative corporate elites of the time in the States, in major European powers. Which is to say, he's a flawed human being like each and every one of us, but he's wrestling with this question of what it means to be human in light of his attempt to define what it means to be modern. And I know there's a lot of talk these days about post-modernity and modernity's over, but the important thing to keep in mind for Paul Robeson was that just as death sat at the center of his definition of what it means to be human, dialogue sit at the center of what it means to be modern. That we make and remake ourselves best when we engage in high-level dialogue, which means we must render ourselves vulnerable, be willing to take a risk to be changed in dialogue. And dialogue is a very rare thing. Very rare thing. Understanding which flows from dialogue is a very rare thing. Dialogue's difficult to pull off because it's too much arrogance and haughtiness. It's too much condescension. Even the discourse these days about multiculturalism, all I have to do is just make it more colorful. No, that's not what we're talking about. The victory of being included is significant, but it is a necessary, not sufficient condition. There has to be respect for the other, a willingness to listen, be pushed, really believe that the other has something to say that will challenge and unnerve you, as opposed to simply making it more comfortable so you can dictate. Still got a long way to go. The great philosophers of dialogue, Martin Buber, Mikhail Bakhtin, Franz Rosenzweig and others, they knew that dialogue is one of the most difficult things to pull off because it presupposes such levels of mutual respect and reciprocity. And Robeson said, I refuse, as a modern black man in America, to be disrespected. And it sounds simple, but that is a lifetime endeavor. No black person makes it from womb to tomb in America without having to deal with disrespect, defamation, disregard in subtle and not so subtle ways. Now, of course, this is true for many Americans across the board, but we're talking about legacies of institutionalized forms of disrespect, and it goes far beyond the law. And it's here, in fact, where conservative brothers and sisters are absolutely right when you say you need more than the law to actually deal with the various dimensions of the race issue. They hit the nail on the head. You can have the best laws in the world, and we need them. Not just on the books, but enforced. But if you don't have the dispositions that cultivate respect, you still have a hollow situation. And Paul Robeson always insisted on respect. Knowing he could be wrong, always believing that if he was right, others ought to take him seriously. Last but not least, the question of what it means to be an American. One of the reasons why I think it's so terrifying to wrestle with Paul Robeson is because He raises for me the fundamental question of American democracies. He echoes the last chapter of volume one of Alexis de Tocqueville's great magisterial treatment of American democracy and democracy in America, a chapter entitled The Three Races That Inhabit This Land. I'm sure many of you recall de Tocqueville concluded that America would never create a full-fledged multiracial democracy. He couldn't imagine it. It's not simply because he was a French aristocrat either. He could not imagine it. Why? Because maybe it was the case that black disrespect or disrespect of black folk, that subjugation of black folk and others was a precondition of the flowering of American democracy. That's a horrifying thought. What if it happens to be the case that the grandest experiment in modern times in democracy, as precious and precarious and fragile as it is, requires a degraded other that helps glue a body politic together and gives them some sense of commonality? It's just that the commonality is predicated on viewing black folk as the marginal one. That's a fundamental question. And Paul Robeson was wrestling with this question. And in so many ways, he's like Frederick Douglass. He's like Martin King. He never really believed that America would not have the capacity to somehow create a multiracial democracy. You look back on his senior thesis at Rutgers, it's called On the 14th Amendment, the Sleeping Giant of the American Constitution. It's a fascinating piece. And you see this unbelievable faith in the ability of American democracy to broaden and include and embrace. But then there's other traditions. Early Martin Delaney and Marcus Garvey and Elijah Muhammad, Miss Louis Farrakhan in our own day, who said, let's go back to de Tocqueville's question. And I know we've made some breakthroughs in progress, but when it comes to the dark side of the American experience in our time, when one looks at the prison and the criminal justice system and the levels of self-celebration, self-congratulation about the thoroughgoing success of the American system, and no focus on one out of two of these black children living in poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world, and one out of three of these young black brothers being linked to the criminal justice system, be it on parole or probation or imprisonment. Talk about how great our educational system is and look at how decrepit our public educational system actually is. Is it still the case that American democracy thrives in ways in which those who bear the social cost remain invisible, unrecognized, cast away so we don't have to see them? That was a challenge for Paul Robeson. He never accepted the nationalist conclusion. Never. And yet, ironically, one of the reasons why he ended his life so disillusioned and disappointed is because he had such high expectations. And that's interesting to me. That's very interesting to me. Black nationalists have no disappointment with America because they never expected that much. Malcolm X was never disappointed with America. Elijah Muhammad was never disappointed with America. So they didn't ever believe the hype. They didn't think that America really had the capacity to create a multiracial democracy across the board. They knew there'd be certain accommodations and adjustments owing to resistance forces and organized citizens and so forth, but they couldn't ever envision the masses of black and brown and red feeling fully a part of American democracy. That's what I find frightening. Because myself, like Paul Robeson, I'm a radical Democrat.
which means either I'm thoroughly naive in thinking that the greatest experiment in democracy, though shot through with white supremacy and male supremacy and vast economic inequality, can be reformed, can be transformed, or I'm duped.
We need a revolution. You're duped.
Well, brother, we're going to see. History is very strange and mysterious, isn't it? Very exactly. Time will tell, and you and I will be swinging. Absolutely right. But Paul Robeson's life says there are no guarantees. And that for the masses of black folk who must live their lives now, for the masses of working people who must live their lives now, the question becomes, what are the credible options there? They can't opt for revolution, capital R, when they've got to feed the child the next day. The revolution is eschatological. Somewhere down the road. Well, here's the strategy. Doesn't look too convincing at the moment. What does one do? Paul Robeson's death, January 23rd, 1976. He dies unrecognized, forgotten by black, white, red. Thank God for some of the communist and socialist brothers and sisters who tried to keep his name alive. Wondering whether that revolution that he had been calling for, or the various kinds of reform that he supported, led by Martin Luther King Jr. and others, would actually have the kind of impact that he wanted. I think it remains an open question. When I look at America now, three major challenges: increasing wealth inequality, debased market culture that reshapes who and what we are, disassembles our souls and reassembles our souls to be consuming, titillated, and stimulating agents rather than publicly interested citizens. When I look at our impoverished public conversation, even in this moment, a strong economy, it doesn't look good. Paul Robeson raises the issue of what it means to come to terms with the tragic in a hotel civilization, in America. And by tragic, I do not mean pathetic. Pathetic's about victims. The tragic's always about agents, exploring all possibilities for freedom, but always against limits and constraints. Plato called a nonge in the Timaeus. The stuff in place, the status quo, and the stuff in ourselves. The envy, the jealousy, the insecurity, the anxiety, the fears that go hand in hand with being human. Can we surmount those? Right now, the legacy of Paul Robeson is politically weak and feeble. It's not dead. It's politically weak and feeble. And whether we have the wherewithal to regenerate and revitalize ourselves, American democracy is an open question. I think we simply have to be honest with ourselves to try to get energized and galvanize one another to do that. And I'm sure there's many, many here in this room, many professors and staff and students who are committed to that. And I simply say to each and every one of you, for those who are committed, I'll be there with you, because as I told the brother, I'm going down fighting, just like Paul Robeson did. Thank you all so very much.
That was Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded at Columbia University in New York in 1999. I'll tell you how you can get copies of this program right after we hear a few words from Paul Robeson and then hear him sing one of his signature songs, Joe Hill.
But I speak as one whose roots are in the soil of my land. I speak as one, as I say, whose fathers and whose mothers toiled in cotton, toiled in tobacco, toil in indigo, toil to create, help create the basic wealth upon which the great land of the United States was built. The great primary wealth came from the blood and from the suffering of my forefathers. And I say, as I have said many times, that I have a right to speak out on their blood, on what they have contributed to that land, and on what I have contributed also as best I can. But I say right here that because of their struggle, I will go around the world, but I'm telling you now that a good piece of that American earth belongs to me.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Paul Robeson singing Joe Hill. You were just listening to Cornel West on The Legacy of Paul Robeson. This classic from the AR Archives, marking Black History Month, was recorded at Columbia University Law School in February 1999. Cornel West is the Bonhoeffer Professor of Philosophy at Union Theological Seminary. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Rami Khoury, Kuhan Pakmander, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Francesca Albanese, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Cornel West on The Legacy of Paul Robeson, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book, The Essential Chomsky, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Andy Lancet recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Paul Robeson singing Old Man River.
Know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and them that plants them is soon forgotten. But Old Man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land in jail. But I keeps laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, we are on Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I have a guest here. So I've got Elizabeth Dietrich, who is a PhD student in literary and cultural studies. So one of your main things is studying early modern theater, so I wanted to start us off with a silly question. So what is your favorite Shakespearean insult?
There are some that are straight up insults, like Queen Margaret calling Richard III a toad, saying he's unfit for any place but hell, right? These are kind of straightforward, but I like the ones that are kind of shade in a conversation, sort of like the line, I do desire that we may be better strangers, which is from As You Like It, a very sort of funny, a lot of humor woven into that particular play. At one point in Hamlet, Polonius says to Hamlet that he's going to take his leave, and Hamlet says that there is no thing that he would more willingly part with than Polonius's company. So these are actually, I think, my favorites, are the sort of sly, situational, conversational insults.
So it's less you egg and more, you know, contextually, that is really brutal.
Definitely. Yeah.
Let's take it back to more things you have done than random questions. But you've actually spent a while like working in professional theater companies. So can you tell me a little about what you did and what it was like?
Yeah, I've worked at a couple of professional theater companies. Haven't had the privilege of working with any in Pittsburgh yet, but I worked with the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, which is in Michigan, surprisingly, perhaps, and a professional theater in Chicago that is now closed called the American Theater Company. With the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, I had a double role as both a dramaturg and a company manager. And then in Chicago, I was in the education department. So a bit of a different sort of thing, less about putting the plays on and more about the outreach endeavors that particular theater did.
Before we go any further, I know a lot of people have asked me what a dramaturg is as an English student, and I don't really know. So can you kind of tell me what that's like?
Yeah. So my first answer is it kind of depends on not only the theater, but the play. It's a very flexible role. My professor of dramaturgy at my undergraduate institution said on the first day of dramaturgy class that the dramaturg is the smartest person in the room, which is, of course, no shade to actors, directors, and all kinds of other brilliant people. But I think what he was going for is the dramaturg sees a picture that is sort of bigger and deeper than